Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Sam Smart, and I'm hosting today's program, which is being recorded at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Grace Hassel, rising senior at Colorado Rocky Mountain School in Carbondale, Colorado. She will be interviewing Joaquin Rodriguez Nieva, assistant professor of physics at Texas A&M University. He received his PhD from MIT and was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University as well as Stanford University. His research is in quantum physics, quantum matter, and statistical physics. He studies emergent phenomena in complex systems. Take it away, Grace.
What was it that initially made you interested in physics?
Okay. Well, first, thank you for having me here. Well, that's actually, I took the long path to physics. It was not so straightforward when I was your age that I wanted to pursue a career in physics. And in fact, my undergrad was in engineering, not in physics. So to give you a little bit of context, I was born and raised in South America. And physics in, or science in general in South America does not have the prominence or the visibility with people. So it's not the first career that would come to your mind when you are trying to pick careers. But on the other hand, I knew I like mathematics. I knew I like, programming, computer science, and so on. So I decided to pursue a career in engineering where I thought that I would get the skills I wanted. And actually I enjoyed the engineering path. But as I was approaching the end of my undergrad, I realized that I liked addressing more fundamental questions rather than engineering problems. And that's when I decided towards the end of my undergrad that I wanted to push a career more in science and in particularly in physics. And that's when I started doing research. I spent an extra year after my undergrad doing a master's with a physics professor where he basically introduced me to basic ideas. And then, of course, I went for PhD and, everything followed from there.
Yes. And what would you mind describing what you're currently researching?
Right. So my field is called condensed matter physics. I don't know if you know anything about it. I think unlike high energy physics or unlike cosmology, I would say condensed matter physics does not have the level of public visibility, but I would say it's also a very exciting field. Basically, the questions that we aim to address is what are the properties of matter, basically when you have large collections of particles and you want to understand properties of matter. So to give you an example, you probably know that as physicists, we aim to understand what are the fundamental constituents of nature. We like to understand what are all the fundamental particles and their interactions. But let's assume that now you start putting particles together. And you start, instead of two particles, you start putting three, four, five particles together. And you would be naive to think that if you know the properties of, individual particles, that will tell you what are the collective properties of the entire system. So, for example, if you want to understand the properties of this table, in 1 gram of this table, there are around 10 to the 23 particles. Atoms. Each atom has a nuclei, each atom has a shell of electrons. They all interact with electromagnetic forces, nuclei interact with nuclear forces, and so on. So it's a very complex system, and just knowing the basic, what are the basic constituents do not tell you anything about, the system as a whole. So to give you, maybe let me ask you a question. Do you know how many particles we can solve analytically? So for example, if I give you a system of n particles, how large can n be before we run into trouble?
I'm not sure.
So we can solve two particles. That's the two-body problem, basically planetary motion. So for planets, we can write analytic solutions that tells you how planets move. They are very predictable. That's why astronomers can predict 100 years in advance that, a comet would pass by through Earth. So it's very, but once we go to three, you run into trouble. So three is is what's called a three-body problem. Three becomes, it's what's called chaos, basically. So if you try to understand and try to write analytic solutions for the three-body problem, you run into trouble where there's no analytic solutions, and basically the trajectories look very different, very unpredictable. In other words, that means that if you perturb one of the bodies just very little, then you will get a very different outcome of the microscopic trajectory. So imagine that we cannot go further away from 3. So imagine if you want to understand 10 to the 23, you would think it's a hopeless task. And that's why we need different tools that go beyond just the fundamental laws of nature to understand our properties of matter. And also there's a second problem, which is the complexity problem. So imagine that I tell you you have 100 particles, and I add one more particle to the system. You would say that's, you add complexity of 1%. You have one extra particle. But in reality, no. Complexity goes like a factor of 2. The system becomes twice as hard to solve. Let me give you, for example, a simple example. Let's assume I give you a coin, and I ask you to flip the coin. So how many outcomes do you have if you have one coin?
2.
Now I give you 2 coins. How many outcomes do you have?
4. No, 4.
That's right. 2 for the first one, 2 for the... So now I give you 3 coins. Then you have 8. So you see that they start to grow, not linearly with the number of coins, but it starts growing exponentially with the number of coins. So this is what basically means that the complexity of the phase space grows. It's what's called the curse of dimensionality. So the systems, as you start adding more and more particles, they become exponentially more complex. So actually, let's get order of magnitude estimates. So usually it's very nice to give rough order of magnitudes. So let's assume I give you 100. Let's say I give you n coins, and I ask you to compute like how many times you get 5 coins, 5 zeros, or 5 ones, so 5 head or tails in a row, right? So you can either find an analytic solution, or alternatively, you can run a computer code that runs through all the outcomes. And then you count how many times you would get a specific answer, right? So if you want to run a computer code, let's assume how many outcomes you have. You have 2 to the number of n coins. So if let's assume a computer does a calculation in microseconds. So if you have 2 coins, you have 4 outcomes times microseconds. That's basically in a blink of an eye, the computer will spit a result. But now let's take 100 coins. Then you have 2 to the 100 times a microsecond. Do you know how long that time scale is?
Mm-mm.
Do you want to guess?
Oh, I don't know.
So that time scale is around 10 to the 16 years. So for to give you a reference, the age of the universe is 10 to the 9 years. So basically, by the time you run a calculations only with 100 possible degrees of freedom, if you want 100 coins, you will be running calculations. I don't want to be too morbid, but when the computer finishes, you will not be here, and the computer won't be here probably, and the universe may not even be here. So that's kind of the challenge of the field. How do we describe systems that have a huge amount of particles? And the key idea is that basically we build statistical descriptions. We say, oh, do we really need to know the position and the momentum of every single particle? And the answer is no. We want to understand collective motions. We want to understand averages. We want to understand statistical behaviors. So my field, basically, what we do is we tend to understand collective motions of large or collective behavior, emerging collective behavior of a large number of particles. And the beauty of it is that you can get new types of behavior that were not, you would never have guessed it from just looking at the individual particles. So that's basically condensed matter physics in a nutshell.
And have you had any breakthroughs on your research while in Aspen?
Well, I just arrived.
Yeah.
So no, the quick answer is no, but I've been, so usually these opportunities are great because I wouldn't say that you will have a specific breakthrough while you are here, but you start, ideas start to cook up here. Like very good ideas start through interactions. I think scientists, although many people think of scientists as people locked in their offices and, not talking to anyone, like most of the best ideas come from opportunities like this one, where you put many people working on a specific topic. There's discussions where should the field go? What new ideas are coming up, what new ideas are interesting, or what are the needs, what are the new challenges of the field. So I would say that here you more than breakthroughs, you get ideas that probably later will lead to breakthroughs. Yeah.
What does your like normal day-to-day look like?
Good. Right. So I do theory, so I don't need to spend time in the lab, fortunately. I wouldn't be able to. So my day, I usually, as faculty, there are many responsibilities that you have to take. One of them, of course, you need to supervise students. That essentially means a big part of your day is having discussions with either your students or with collaborators, making sure that research and progress is going forward. So usually, you know, part of the day, I would say one quarter of my day is having discussions with people. But as a theory, I think it's also very important to have, let's say, an extended period, let's say 3-4 hours every day where you can deeply focus on work. I think, although many of your students do a lot of the work, I think if you are not actively pursuing a project of your own where you are, you know, it's like maintaining your mental fitness, doing work yourself, that you can do it in silence and deeply focused on it, then that's why I think it's important to have to separate chunks of the day, a couple of hours where you can deeply focus. And then, of course, there are all the responsibilities of being a faculty. You have to teach, you have to train grad students. So basically, I would say, one third of my day is focusing on research. One third of the day goes to training and having discussions with students, and the other third would probably go to doing more the general, faculty, the tasks of being a faculty in general, of participating in committees or also teaching and training students.
Do you have any memorable moments in your career that have made an impact on you or your research?
Right. Well, there are many, many aspects that I like. So I can tell you something that I particularly enjoy of my research. So something very nice, of course, when you are a theorist, it's nice to write nice theories or things that describe, interesting phenomena. But it's even nicer when there are experiments that actually, show that what you predicted in your theories actually is true, right? That otherwise you're just writing theories for the sake of theories. And I think it was some of my biggest satisfactions came when doing theory work that later got confirmed by experiments. Like later somebody produced the data, took specific interest in the work I did. They decided to invest resources to actually carry out an experiment, which usually can take years and, a lot of money in terms of material and in terms of running experiments and of people, and, then showing that the results were actually true and getting publications with them, with the experiments. So I think those are the most satisfying moments as a theorist, when somebody does the experiments and says, oh, you were actually right, your theory was correct.
What is your favorite part of researching physics?
My favorite, I think it's the learning. What I enjoy about physics quite a lot is the skill sets that it gives you. It's the mindset of the physicists, the tools, the ideas that it's not just for physics. I would argue that physicists. I have many colleagues who decided not to pursue an academic career after their PhD and are doing remarkably well in fields completely outside physics. It's like it gives you tools, analytical, numerical tools, ideas, ways to organize ideas, right? It's like the structure in which physics is organized that is very valuable. And in particular, what I like is I like to think about physics like I don't know, if it's like a sport, like you're trying to learn new skills, new tools, new ideas, or new frameworks that you can use to study new problems, right? So, and I think that's the beauty of it. You never get bored of it. There's always something going on. There's always new ideas that you can pursue. So I think it's the being a learner for your entire life, right? It's always being learning the latest about science, the latest about physics, and also being able to relate to fields outside, you know, your own field you know, of expertise. For example, now there are two workshops going in parallel. One of them is specifically on what I do, which is understanding, for instance, properties of matter, particularly quantum matter and exotic materials. But there's another workshop going on, for instance, understanding biological systems. And you would say they have nothing to do with each other. They are completely orthogonal. But many of the ideas are actually the underlying ideas, and the underlying challenges are the same. You still have a lot of degrees of freedom. You still have a huge phase space. You have a lot of complexity. And what you want to understand is why structure emerges still, you know, even though all this complexity, how is it possible that that structure can emerge?
How has your background or past experiences influenced your approach to physics?
Good. Right. So that's a good question. I don't know. I never thought about that one. So as I mentioned to you, I was trained as an engineer. So it's not surprising that I went into areas where you want to understand why things or materials or why things that we are used to behave the way they behave. Like, I never aimed to pursue, for instance, high energy physics or cosmology. I felt that was already too far from my background. But condensed matter physics, I think, was the perfect field for me because I was always interested in this problem of complexity. So one of the things I like about the field is that it's very much connected to technologies. So, for example, everything that you see today, computers, transistors, and all modern technology is based on physics that was developed in the 50s. All the idea of semiconductors, band structure, and so on. So all the ideas that we are pursuing today are ideas that could potentially have implications or impacts in technology 30 years from now, right? So it's kind of a nice thing to be in a field where you could potentially like envision how the world would look like 50 years from now. So I think, although I do theoretical research and basic research, I still always have in the back of my mind, okay, why is this useful for? Why could this lead to a new technology? Could this lead to something interesting that could be used for something useful besides just the fact that it's interesting on a scientific point of view?
What advice would you give someone who is interested in pursuing physics in the future?
Yeah, that's a... So I can tell you an advice that I received, which actually was very good. Don't focus too much on what you want to become 5 years down the road. Focus more on getting the skills that you want to get. So, for example, if you are interested in physics or in general or on any technical field, aim to be good at the basic stuff. Aim to be good at math. Aim to be good at computer science. Learn the basics of physics. I'm an example that you don't need to be a physicist as an undergrad to become a physicist in the long term. Because if you already decide at this stage what you want to be 5 years down the road, on the one hand, you are probably closing opportunities that may come up to you that may be more interesting and more appealing and more suitable to your personality. But also you create images of what a physicist is doing, and maybe you will get disappointed when you get there. So it's like you will start thinking, oh, as physicist, I will be doing this great stuff, presenting all results in conferences, getting a lot of prizes, but you may be missing the fact of how much work it takes. And then when you create those images, you probably will get disappointed when you get there and about how much work you actually have to do. So I would say always focus on the basics, always go to the fundamentals, because if you are good in math, if you are good in the basic stuff, if you are good at learning, fundamental things, then you can go into any other field without problem. So for example, I feel that today, it's not what I'm planning to do, but let's assume that today I wanted to switch fields completely, say I want to learn something new from scratch. I wouldn't be intimidated by it. I'm not saying that it would be easy, but I feel like I learn how to learn. So I learn how to get the skills that I need to learn. I know how to search for them. And I know how to do something productive with those skills. So I would say focus always on the basics, on the fundamentals, on the math, on the computer science, on learning basic physics, learning chemistry, learning biologies, and have an open mind You don't have to decide today. Right? You can do your undergrad and then make a much informed decision.
What would you say makes a successful physicist?
A successful physicist? I don't know. There are many, many. I think there's only, actually, no. I would say there's one thing that makes a successful physicist. Is if you can produce high-quality results that are helpful to other people. In other words, if people notice your work, if people cite your work, if people use your work to build new knowledge, you're not just producing work for the sake of producing work, that actually it's going back into the system and people are citing you and people are inviting you to conferences and people are basically noticing what you do. It's like being a writer, for example. If you write a book, you want people to buy it and read it. In the same way, as a physicist, you want to produce work that has a lot of intellectual merit, that people appreciate it, that they notice it, and it brings new ideas. So I would say that the ultimate goal of a successful physicist is to produce an idea that everybody else will later use for their own research. I think that's, of course, you can also think about awards, but awards, you know, that's very subjective, of course. It's who gets awards is defined by committees and there's politics, but who gets high quality results and whose work gets more, you know, noticed, and that's more objective, right? So if you produce good science, people will notice it.
You talked about like the collaboration a little bit earlier. Would you say that like that's like one of the most important parts, is like being able to collaborate with other people? And
I think so. I think being able, again, when you do physics, you don't do it in vacuum, right? There's a community.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily collaborating in the sense of writing papers together, but making your ideas relevant to other people and finding common interests, finding common grounds, I would say. That's kind of the key, the important. That's why there exists conferences like this one, right? They have a topic, they have a theme, and they bring together all the people working on those themes. Because it's very hard that a single person can produce, you know, something big in vacuum, right? It's usually in this type of opportunities where you talk, you collaborate, and you exchange ideas that basically the field steers into new directions and new, you know, new opportunities arise for, you know, new discoveries. So I would say, yes, it's a collective behavior. So we all act collectively as a field rather than individually as scientists.
One thing I actually wanted to ask you, Joaquin,
mm-hmm.
is when you speak about sort of like getting together, working for in a sort of collaborative group for something in the future,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned, you know, it could be 30 years down the line,
mm-hmm.
50 years, or maybe never, who mm-hmm. knows. Does that... It must be quite humbling, is it not, to work on something that you almost know will never like come to like full fruition in sort of a technological way during your like at least sort of professional life.
That's totally
is
correct.
That something that you sort of
yes.
deal with often and
well,
just accepted.
I would say it's even worse, right? Being a scientist is very humbling. Because you would argue, you would think, like, if you ask a person who is not a scientist, what is a scientist? Actually, how would you define a scientist? Or what would be your definition of scientist?
How would I define a scientist?
Yeah, how do you perceive a scientist, a physicist?
A physicist specifically?
Yeah.
I would definitely, if I were to sort of describe one and
mm-hmm.
characterize one from the ones that I have met,
mm-hmm.
it would definitely be sort of like, humble and a lot more outgoing than I would have sort of stereotypically expected.
Okay.
Is something I would sort of characterize a lot of the physicists that
mm-hmm.
I've met as. And then just
and there's a reason
things like
for
curious
that.
And sort of intelligent, of course.
Right. That's, well, the reason why they're humble, I would say, there's a reason for that. So usually when people think about scientists, they know of people who are experts on a field, that they know quite a lot. They spend, you know, their entire career studying a specific subject and they are the best in the field. Like they have a huge knowledge about it. But the way I see as a scientist is someone who is ignorant about nature, but is aware of that ignorance. They know that they don't know and they need to know the answer to what they are looking for, right? So I think I like to think about physicists as, or scientists in general, as people who are ignorant but aware of their ignorance. It's what drives them, right? So in that sense, it's very humbling because you are never, I don't know anyone who is in the mood of, or who is in the state of saying, I know everything about my field. I think you don't hear that, right? But you actually are on the opposite regime where you say, oh, we don't know anything about this. We should know by now. So I think being a scientist is a very humbling career. And of course, then there's also that thing that you mentioned that, yes, you spend a lot of time working on specific projects and you never know what impact those projects have, right? So you never know what will happen to your research 5-10 years, whether it will, you know, they would be relevant 10 or 15 years, and that's perfectly fine. That, you know, that's how science works. There are only very, very, very few works, like there is like lottery, or few works that persist, you know, 50, 100 years in time. So most of the science, even today, advances so fast that science, like 10 years down the road, physics will look very different than what it looks now. In fact, physics looks very different when I was a PhD student, the topics that people are looking at, right? So everything is evolving very rapidly. And you have to accept that you never know how relevant your ideas are going to be 10 years. So that's part of the game, right? So that's how it is.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Joaquin. It's been a very informative, very interesting interview. And thank you to Grace, our high school intern. She's done a great job. We hope you enjoyed the radio physics today. For more information about our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org or follow us on our socials at Aspen Physics. Thank you very much.